You are connected to Real Deals webinar number 4. I'm your host, Nicholas Neveling, and welcome to today's discussion on the ILPA 3.0 principles and their impact on the evolution of LPGP reporting. Many apologies to those of you who have been waiting for us to log on. I am afraid that we had a few technical issues. Thank you for bearing with us, and we will endeavor to get through the program as quickly as we can. Good afternoon. In the summer of 2014, Andrew Bowden, then still with the SEC, gave his now famous Spreading the Sunshine in Private Equity speech, which was soon followed by an unprecedented examination of the industry from regulators and investors. It seemed to mark a turning point for transparency. 5 years on, and debate around how GPs and LPs should communicate remains as lively as ever, with ongoing discussion around everything from subscription line finance, co-investments and GP-led secondaries to the always important terms around fund economics and fees and carry. This is a crucial debate that is shaping the future of the private equity industry. To help dig into this broad and complex subject, I'm joined this afternoon by a panel of experts working across all sides of the GP-LP ecosystem. My first guest is Jennifer Choi, Managing Director of Industry Affairs at ILPA. Jennifer, good morning, I believe, where you are. I believe you're in Salt Lake City. Can you hear us?
That's correct. Hello, everyone.
Jennifer, can you hear us?
I can indeed. Hopefully you can.
Jennifer, we've made it. Thank you so much for your patience. We are live, and apologies again to everyone. We're up and running. Jennifer, thank you for your patience. Just to set the scene, I wonder if you could briefly outline what the ILPA 3.0 principles are there for and how this latest version differs from earlier iterations.
Certainly happy to do so, and thanks once again for including ILPA in this conversation. The principles, when first created and published in 2009, were really the first effort by LPs to articulate, at the time, what felt like a somewhat idealized set of concepts and best practices structured around the rubric of enhanced transparency, stronger alignment of interest, and improved fund governance. And that continues to be the case today. The principles for ILPA and our members have always served as a foundation for the positions that we take and the best practices and educational resources that we provide. This third edition now, many years on, was really an effort to both expand upon earlier guidance, touching on a lot of the issues, Nicholas, that you have already enumerated, but in addition to provide some clarifying guidance, taking into account the fact that the industry has evolved in many ways. And certainly, as you pointed out, now as a regulated industry, both in the US and in Europe, and enhanced expectations from investors around transparency, we wanted to make sure that we address that in all its forms within this latest edition.
Great. Thank you so much, Jennifer. My next guest is Neil McDougall, who is the chairman of pan-European private equity firm Silverfleet Capital. ILPA is an influential stakeholder in the LPGP relationship, but there are, of course, many other organizations involved in this dialogue, one of which is Invest Europe, of which your firm is a member. What areas of the LPGP relationship has Invest Europe focused on, and have you noted any differences in approach between the two organizations?
Well, good afternoon or good morning, Jennifer. I should say when I started at Silverfleet back in 1989, the then chairman of what was EVCA, European Venture Capital Association, which is now Invest Europe, was actually one of my colleagues. And I think the difference is probably where you evolved from. I think Invest Europe and BVCA have come from being GP associations rather than LP associations. I would say that I think there's probably about 95% overlap in terms of reasonableness of where everybody's got to. The differences between what is included in 3.0 from ILPA versus the latest guidelines from Invest Europe are not very big at all. Mind you, it's probably the 5% that we're here to talk about.
Indeed. And that leads us on nicely to my third guest, Jeffrey Geiger, who's the head of the private equity funds and co-investment practice at USS. Jeffrey, very nice to have you here. As an LP, do you find the guidelines produced by the likes of ILPA, Invest Europe, helpful? And do you sense that the managers you back believe that they are, important and a useful basis for negotiation?
Absolutely. I think they've been extremely helpful in the past since the first issue in kind of establishing a baseline for negotiations, kind of on a comply, explain basis when you're going through the negotiation. And I do think, you know, we wouldn't back managers if they didn't agree that at least the high-level principles behind these guidelines are not appropriate. I mean, I think, you know, overall, it's easy to be aligned when things are going well. What's important is to lay down the rules for when things aren't quite so going in the right direction. And as we know, our industry goes up and down in popularity, and we need to be prepared to try to have as harmonious a relationship as we can with our GPs.
Okay. We're also joined today by Hugh Oliver Stacey, who's an executive director in the Investor Solutions team at IQEQ. Hugh, one of the topics that we will be covering later in today's discussion are the shifts in investor reporting in private equity. Indeed, many of these can be tracked back to that now infamous Bowden speech. But as someone in the industry working with these sort of topics day to day, how have reporting requirements increased? And if so, what have been the implications for GPs and their IR teams?
Thanks, Nick. Reporting requirements have certainly increased as the asset class itself has matured, both in terms of the content, the depth of content, the standardization, which is now being sort of encouraged by the industry, and also the frequency of reporting, how you actually give the LPs those reports and what sort of access. So it's definitely a big increase in terms of the reporting, and I think that we'll see that only increasing as things go on.
Okay, thank you, Hugh. It's also a great pleasure to welcome Gus Black, who's a partner at Law Firm Deckert, to the panel. Gus, good afternoon. You probably see more term sheets than most of us. And I wanted to ask along a similar line, around two things, really. Have you noticed any material shifts in LPAs and side letters? And have you made any specific observations around shifts, particularly on fund economics?
Mm-hmm. So, if the question is as a result of ILPA 3.0, I would say I think it's kind of early to have seen much coming through. I agree with the sort of comply or explain. But if we step back and talk about shifts more generally, it's clearly been a pretty buoyant fundraising environment. That fund sizes have been increasing. Success of funds in general we've seen getting away quite nicely without the need to have material shifts on LPA terms. And the same goes for economics. But by that token, whilst the LPA and the headlines might not have changed very much, clearly there is, I think, a greater awareness now on the part of LPs that if they're allocating to a successor fund with a manager that is already making plenty enough to pay the team and keep the lights switched on, there may be a discussion to be had around fund economics on a re-up
with a large manager. Interesting. Plenty there to pick up on later in our discussion. But I'd now like to introduce my final guest, who is Gaurav Marwa, who is a technical director at IQEQ. Gaurav, welcome. Gus has already given us a flavor for some of the developments around fund economics. And I guess that fees, carry, expenses are ultimately where the rubber hits the road, as it were. What have your observations been around fund economics and
any changes? Principles, as everyone would have seen, have definitely evolved compared to the previous version. Fees and expenses have received a fair bit of attention compared to, again, the previous versions. It's not only around just the best practices on fees and expenses, but there's been a lot of specific and stronger recommendations around some of the calculation methodologies around management fees and carry computations. I would say the broader principles around fund economics, the more prescriptive and detailed guidance, is a great initiative in, you know, establishing a clear benchmark and, you know, for both sides of the fund ledger and addressing some of the concerns raised by recent regulatory examinations as well. However, I think there are some more detailed elements or specific recommendations around the calculation methodologies, which from my experience are a bit debatable and are not common practice from in the closed-ended space. Having administered about 600 plus funds, there are a few recommendations which we haven't seen trickle down into the LPAs or, you know, the GP LLP negotiations.
Okay, thank you, Gaurav. Some very interesting points, and again, plenty for us to explore later in the conversation. I'd now like to go back to Jennifer. Jennifer, are you still with us? Just checking that you're still with us.
I am.
Great, Jennifer. Next question directed to you. I don't think it is unfair to say that since that Bowden speech that we've mentioned, the LPGP relationship has perhaps been portrayed as more adversarial than it maybe was before. Do you sense that is a true reflection of the zeitgeist? And is it the LPs in a battle with GPs over fees, co-investments, subscription lines, economics, etc.? Or is that a little too simplistic and binary a way of seeing where we are at the moment?
Nicholas, it's a lovely setup. It's not quite that simple nor binary. And I would say adversarial is not the way I would describe it. I would say, having had several conversations with Jeffrey and Neil about this over the last few years, there is a lot more focus on how our GPs and LPs working together to enhance the reputation of the industry, going back to what Jeffrey said about the need to find and discover a way to enhance the brand of the industry for everyone concerned when times are not quite as benign and good as they are today. I would say, rather than adversarial, I would say that the dynamic has certainly shifted. I think our members often remark that, at least in the negotiating dynamic, the balance of power, the favor, has tilted to the GP in a way it hasn't for some time. I would say that the bulk of the back and forth in the negotiation that we're aware of is less so about the economic terms, although, of course, you see a lot more movement in the co-investment space, in part as a reaction to the inability to move the needle much on the economic terms. And that's an effort in part from some LPs to try and discover opportunities for cost savings in the relationship overall. But I would say governance is probably one area where LPs are really going much more toe-to-toe with GPs in negotiations, specifically on issues such as fiduciary duty. And then I'd also say less about battling over fees per se or economics per se. I do think that LPs find it somewhat challenging to get the requisite transparency they seek from all GPs they are backing. And I'd love to hear more from the other panelists about their experience with this. But I would say fiduciary duty, governance, more broadly in investor rights, and the ability to get that requisite transparency to really understand, as an LP, what are you buying and what does it cost you?
Okay, Jennifer, thank you. Jeffrey, I had a specific question for you about secondaries and subscription lines, but quickly, I just wondered if you had any thoughts with respect to the points that Jennifer raised. Is it governance where the real hard negotiations are, or have you had a different experience?
Yeah, I mean, there certainly is the backdrop of the industry is larger funds and a large amount of capital going to the asset class when, you know, the rest of the asset management industry is seeing lower margins, probably seeing higher margins in private equity. And there's not much that LPs can do against that at this moment. They are using co-investment as a lever. The larger investors are using co-investments as a tool to bring down the cost of implementation today. But overall, probably the pendulum is in the favor of GPs today.
Yeah. Neil, any thoughts?
Well, I have to make a confession. I was once an LP as well. And I do remember a certain gentleman, Tim Collins, and I was having a very robust debate with him about why he hadn't bothered to convene an advisory committee, given that he was proposing to fundamentally change the investment strategy of his fund and actually stop it being a closed-end 10-year fund and turn it into a perpetual evergreen listed Belgian entity. And he had the temerity to tell me that my man was an idiot and didn't know what he was talking about. So I think life has moved considerably since then. So I think let's put this all into perspective. The the gap, I don't think, is anywhere near as big as it used to be. And I think, as Jennifer says, regulation in the United States has actually helped, I think. The SEC's focus on fees has helped, because now people on that side of the pond know that somebody can look over their shoulders and say, what was that all about? Please explain how that ties back to your LPA. Here in Europe, in the UK in particular, we've been regulated by the FCA for a very, very long time. We've always had the awareness that, you know, somebody could actually ask us to explain how we came to those numbers, and actually discipline us accordingly if we hadn't done it properly. So look, I think, you know, the relationship is generally pretty good. The money would not be coming into the industry if people fundamentally felt uncomfortable with what they're putting the money into. And I think the ILPA guidelines in terms of fees that and costs that are, you know, that can be offset and should be offset, shouldn't be offset, is actually quite helpful. I reading that, I can't disagree with most of those, I agree with most of those recommendations, but I did the double negative. So I think there's definitely good stuff here that people should read and take on board. As to which way the pendulum's swinging and where the balance is, that changes every couple of years.
Okay, indeed. And that would be a whole other rabbit hole, which we won't go down this afternoon. Jeffrey, so it sounds like the picture generally is pretty good. Relations are strong. But I suppose if there are some areas of contention, two that I may pick up are around GP-led secondaries and how co-investment is shared and allocated. If we hone in on those two points specifically, are you as an LP comfortable with how each of these two things are managed? And do you believe that you are being treated fairly when a GP-led secondary does come onto the table, or when co-investment is offered, or indeed not?
Yeah, I think I have two different answers for those two questions.
Yeah.
On the co-investment side, I think the industry has evolved from a few years ago, probably 10 years ago. The industry tried to allocate co-investment on a formulaic basis. And I think people discovered that that didn't work because they ended up with failed syndication processes, co-investment allocations that were too small to be practical. And now we've moved to a kind of free market. People are getting allocated based on GP discretion that relates to the LP's ability to take up the co-invest and ability to execute and what works for the transaction. And that does seem to work. So I think we're relatively happy as long as there's transparency and everybody knows what the rules are, then we can all play the game according to those rules. On GP-led secondaries, I think, I mean, there's a number of things that hide behind that headline, but there is a clue in the headline that they are being led by GPs, not LPs. And LPs should be aware when those are coming their way, where the interests are. Now, it can be everything from a tender, which is generally not too controversial, to a single asset a GP transaction, which may have a lot more conflicts of interest. And that's where good governance and a good governance construct, as advocated by the principals, comes into play, where the advisory board can scrutinize those conflicts of interest, and if they're presented in a transparent way, can then help all the LPs evaluate the options that are on the table and the conflicts that come with those.
Okay, just quickly, I wanted to go to Neil on subscription lines and also co-invest, but are you more comfortable with how these, especially on the GP-led secondary side, how they're being run as to 5 years ago when we first started to see them happening in greater volumes?
There's certainly GPs are taking more care than they used to. There's a lot more people, a lot more time is being afforded to LPs to evaluate it. I think there's still some progress to be made. A lot of these, they'll hire an advisor, but often the advisor is working for the LPs. It's not, I think the LPs should be involved in the appointment of the advisor. For example, that's something that is in the principles, but you don't see followed that much. There's still a lot of work to be done. Ultimately, offering liquidity to the asset class is a positive, and we should all kind of encourage that. I don't think we should discourage GP-led secondaries. It's a matter of principles, but I think they are still evolving.
Okay, very interesting summary. Thank you, Jeff. Neil, just before we move on to another related subject, briefly on co-invest, and then I'll set a question about subscription lines. But on co-invest, from the GP point of view, and I often hear grumbles, lots of LPs ask for co-invest, but when it comes to signing up, suddenly there's nobody there for you. Is that a fair representation of the situation? And is a GP rational and justified in allocating co-invest to those LPs who he or she knows can deliver?
Well, I suppose the first thing to say is that this is probably the area that taxes the IR department more than anything else, okay? So, with respect to my colleagues and friends from IQ EQ, this is the one that uses up a big chunk of time. When you go out to your LPs, you don't know what else they have in their portfolio, what experiences their investment committee have had, what exposures they've got, what strange rules they've got that allow them not, that they don't want to make an investment in that particular company. So I guess the ratio, it's not there's nobody there for you, but you might have to go 15 people to wind up with two that are genuinely interested and can deliver.
Okay.
Sometimes they're busy on other stuff. Sometimes they've done all the investment they need to do that year. Sometimes somebody on the IC once did something similar 20 years ago that didn't work. That's a fairly laborious process, but equally, the GPs have an obligation to have a properly constructed portfolio. Most of the time, you're taking co-investment out because you shouldn't hold it, otherwise you're going to over-concentrate your portfolio. We find a way. I don't believe there's ever been more co-investment done than there is now. So this is working somehow, but it is the area where we're having to invest more in IR functionality.
Quickly, I know we are rapidly running through the points that we wanted to discuss, but quick line on subscription line. And I know there has been some discussion around the fact that returns, carry payouts, etc., should be adjusted according to how subscription lines are applied and used. How do you feel about that as a GP? Is that reasonable, or are we getting a little bit too mired in unnecessary detail?
Well, look, I this is probably one of the 5% where GPLP doesn't agree. The bit I'd agree with Jennifer and Ilpa on the 3.0 is subscription lines do need to be brought under control. I believe have been fairly egregious examples of misusing them. The idea they should be sort of for up to 12 months, and that you should clean them down. I think that's all good stuff. I do think, however, that private equity should be rewarded or not rewarded based on actual cash flows, not hypothetical. Once you open Pandora's box to hypotheticals, God knows where it's going to finish. There are other ways that you can postpone drawing down money from investors if you have earnouts with the people you're buying from. That's one way you can do it. I mean, drawdown bridging facilities are quite helpful in two respects. If you're selling to a private equity firm, it means you're more likely to get the money faster. We had one deal close over Christmas a couple of years back, and the buying fund didn't have a drawdown facility, and then they had to give 15 days notice to their investors, and it was over Christmas, and suddenly 2 months it disappeared. So there are some benefits. Does it help the GPs a little bit? I think it adds a little bit of a little bit to the IRR. It's not massive. Whenever we've done the analysis, it hasn't frankly made that big a difference. I think I agree with you, but it's something where guidelines are helpful, and going to the complier explain that Jeffrey mentioned it. So it's a good starting point for the discussion.
Okay. Thank you. I wanted to now turn to Gus maybe, and Gus, maybe just try and get your view on whether the LPA has evolved to sort of adjust to sort of all these new things that we've been discussing. If you look at the drafting of LPAs and how documentation has been drafted, have you seen any shifts with respect to how co-invest is offered and shared, and indeed how restructurings are led and how subscription lines are used?
Okay, so if we take them in turn, I would probably put all these things in the 5%.
Okay, yes, indeed.
Because there are certainly some areas around, starting with co-invest, where that's going to be more in the explain side of things than the comply side. Yes, it's very nice in principle to set out in the LPA and the BPM exactly how everything is going to be shared and allocated, but in practice, the GP isn't going to know that until they know who their LPs are. And then they're not going to know it until they've actually done a few co-invests and decided which LPs are able to execute and which ones aren't. And so from that standpoint, I just don't think you can be prescriptive in the LPA. We would certainly push to have very general allocation provisions. And that's the sort of reality for most things. And if an investor is big enough, they're going to get to find out about co-invest rights through an MFN process. And if they're not, they're not. They'll live with the conflicts disclosures. Now, the caveat to that is where co-invest arrangements actually do create a real conflict tension, and then it becomes a disclosable issue. And an example of that might be if an LP had done a side letter arrangement giving them such a preferential deal or incentivizing the LP, the GP, into a co-invest program. We saw one, for example, recently where the economics was such that the GP was clearly going to be incentivized to fill up a co-invest bucket, and that then had to be disclosed to other investors. But that's always the case if there's a conflict. It has to be washed with disclosure. What was the next one? GP-led restructurings. Again, it's another area where, in principle, it would be nice to have a clear process. But in reality, you could pretty much bet that whatever you'd legislated for in the time of forming the fund, dial forward 10 years, life might have changed, and you're going to have to go and get it agreed with the LPs anyway. So why bother spending pages of LPA drafting, trying to put a process together? The one exception there is we do sometimes see the LPAC being, you know, more enshrined as a part of any GP-led restructuring than perhaps historically it would have been. And I think there's a lot of sense to that because, again, in reality, GP is probably going to want to go out to the wider investor body with the blessing of the LPAC for something as a commercial matter.
Okay.
Sublines, again, I would put that very firmly in the 5% bucket. Haven't seen a lot of movement on the LPA. There's going to be some technical stuff that's dependent on the fund domicile as to what you need in there. We tend to see a lot less pushback from LPs around the economics of subscription line financing than the sort of industry press or others would have you believe. In our experience, what LPs care about is not having to do lots of information provision and making sure that they're able to assign their interest, especially to affiliates, without having to go back to the lender. So there's been a little evolution there, but nothing shattering.
Nothing major. Gus, while we're with you, I wondered if I could also just ask you about fund economics, especially around things like the waterfall and the hurdle rate. Mm-hmm. Certain firms, we won't mention any names, have decided not to use the hurdle.
Yes.
We're going to deal-by-deal waterfalls instead of whole fund waterfalls.
Yes.
Have you sensed any kind of increase in debate around, I guess, those two core elements?
No, I think the hard hurdle concept is another one in the 5% area.
Yeah.
Because we are still seeing a lot of GPs getting a preferred return hurdle.
Okay.
I think, and I would agree with the sentiment, whether it's SEC driven or LP driven or just the sort of industry growing up, the light that has been shone on fees and expenses and the extra thought that now has to go into that is I think generally helpful. You look back at some of the old expenses provisions, you could pretty much throw anything, anything in there, and it's a generally constructive process. So that's where we have seen a lot of focus. But headline economics, not so much.
Yeah, Jennifer, sorry if you're still there with us. I just wondered, if you look at your membership and conversations you've had with your membership, do you sense that they are more on the front foot with respect to discussions around preferred return, clawbacks, management fees, waterfalls, or if everything's going well, you're into a top quartile manager that's performing, these things suddenly become less important, which I guess Jeffrey alluded to earlier. Just interested in your insights and the conversations you have with your membership.
I do believe that as far as the, as Gus put it, the headline economics conversations, if you have conviction in that manager's ability to deliver similar performance in future and you've sort of underwritten to that, I think you're certainly, from what we hear from our members, going to be more amenable to the way in which, you know, the preferred return, the waterfall is structured that might depart from the really aspirational points that we made in the principles. And I should just point out that those, you know, such as the hard hurdle, we did that knowing it was an aspirational point off market, but it was an expression of what would be, you know, a reflection of the strongest alignment possible, strongest alignment of interest between GPs and LPs, but certainly expected it would fall into the 5% as everybody has called out. I would say too, and just in response to some of the points that Gus made, while we have not seen movement within the LPA, I think on a lot of these things, there was never an expectation that the LPA was the best place to lay out all of these details, because as Gus points out, the document itself has a long shelf life, and it necessarily has to. And it's not just, you know, 10 plus 2, it might be 10 plus 2 plus another 3. And so it's difficult to add drafting language that can accommodate for every scenario and the interests of every LP in that fund. But we do think a lot of the things LPs are looking for and getting are some commitments to disclosure, to transparency, to that explain piece in the comply or explain construct. And that's happening often in the side letters, less so in the LPA itself. And just one other thing to share with everyone, we are on the cusp of releasing a model limited partnership agreement that takes a lot of the ideas in principles version 3 and translates them into simplified legal language as a model, not an expectation of a template. And I want to make sure that distinction is clear. But again, from what we are hearing from members and observing, a lot of this conversation is happening outside of the LPA itself, but it is happening nonetheless.
Jennifer, thank you. Jeffrey, just quickly, any thoughts from your side on the investor side around the economics?
Yeah, I mean, on economics, as I said, I think we're in a period where successful fund managers can drive a hard bargain. What we are seeing, I think, is definitely an improvement around governance and principles of governance, you know, partly to do with ILPA, but also maturing of the industry, and that's a good thing. And you know, on economics, you know, it is a negotiation. This is a private market. It's a negotiated market. We're all, you know, aspiring to very good net returns, and you know, people will calculate into that appropriate cost.
Okay, thank you, Jeffrey. Right, I now wanted to move on to Hugh and Gaurav, just to ask about the practicalities of reporting and day-to-day LPGP interaction. I think it's clear that there is a very open dialogue, but certainly a more intense and detailed dialogue than maybe there would have been 5 years ago. I don't think that's unfair. Hugh, maybe if I can come to you first. I guess if you're a large manager, you have the resources to invest in the IR, the finance, the reporting infrastructure. It gets a bit more difficult if you're a smaller mid-market partner-led firm that, you know, you don't have the fee income to invest in all those good things. How are GPs approaching this and managing their obligations, especially those smaller houses?
So I think you're right. I think the large GPs, it's probably easier for them to you know, buy a software. But even that is a challenge because there's a plethora of different software platforms available for reporting, whether consolidated reporting to the investors, so it's internal or external. They all come from a slightly different background, different focus. You know, and then you know, you've got to work out which one's most suited to you as a group, and therefore you then have to go through a tender, which in itself can be quite complex. Then you've got to work out how you're going to implement that for the different stakeholders within the group. And that can take an awful long time and come at a vast expense. So we're definitely seeing the larger managers, you know, trying to sort of buy the software themselves. But for the smaller managers, yeah, you're right, there is a challenge in terms of cost, but they're a bit more nimble, to be a bit more flexible, and a lot of those guys are going down the sort of outsourced route. So rather than having to buy software themselves, they're leveraging off our software as a service provider, and therefore being able to get access, and also help and support. Because obviously, if you, again, if you buy a software, it can be the best software available, but if you're not putting the right data in, and it's inconsistent, and there's inaccuracies, then it's irrelevant. So a lot of our guys or our clients now are saying to us, you know, can you collate the data? Can you do a six-eyes check on the data, input it into your software platform, and we can just be the end user? And we can do that because obviously we've got economies of scale, we have developers in-house, and we have the software we can actually tailor it to that individual fund manager. I think the issue comes is, you know, I think it's great that ILPA has done the sort of portfolio company checklist, and you know, that's pretty comprehensive, and that's all great for people like ourselves. And it's like 70 data points, you know, and I think that is again a just reflection of how the asset class has matured and sophisticating, is becoming a larger part of an LP portfolio. So that's all fantastic. But the issue comes is, depending on those type of investors that you have, you might have a small family office or a pension fund investor, they might not be able to track that themselves. So, you know, they might be doing anything on Excel spreadsheets. So are they going to be able to actually utilize that data, turn to intelligence, and be able to report it on for themselves? A lot of the big LPs are using software, again, utilizing that. But again, it's just dependent on the relationship and dependent on the LP base, as to the level of information you have to provide.
Yeah. Just picking up on that point that you raised, Gaurav, about standardization, you mentioned that there still are very different kinds of pockets of LPs. Is standardization an obvious way to streamline reporting, to make the process faster and less expensive for both sides, or are we still a long way off from delivering that?
Sure. Just before I go into the question, I think I would like to thank a couple of co-panelists who addressed my debate about the 5% remit. So I think that was good to know that some of our views are shared.
Okay.
Good. Sorry, going back to your question, yes, I agree. Standardization will make processes more efficient. It will make it more cost-effective, especially in the long run once the initial implementation costs have been absorbed and incurred. There is a definite move towards standardized reporting. Whether big or small, I would say is debatable, especially in light with, you know, some of these industry global initiatives like ILPA in West Europe and so on. And we produce a range of templates for our GP clients as well. So I think industry is moving in the direction of standardization, but as I said, big or small is debatable depending on LP's requirements as well. It will make everyone's life easier because you know, when it comes to investor reporting, data analytics, fee ratification, and so on. And there'll be an added cost saving for the GPs as well, because it will reduce the number of investor queries, which we see with a lot of our GPs as well at times, getting a lot of ad hoc queries, producing ad hoc reports. It will, you know, reduce that frequency, which will make it cost effective for everyone involved. However, I wanted to address it in two folds. There are LPs looking for customized and flexible solutions, even at times, which will meet their specific regulatory needs, but also very specific institutional and technological needs as well. So for them, sometimes a one-size-fits-all situation doesn't work. Whereas, like Hugh mentioned as well, they might not have the same platforms which can absorb an ILPA template before and, you know, have those data points allocated where they might prefer very simple reporting or something which might be very specific to their core jurisdiction in where they are, like a German pension fund might require something which is very specific to, you know, the German reporting rather than ILPA reporting. So I think our view is that most of the time the GP reporting, yes, we do standardized reporting and customized reporting, but we think most of the time it's LP driven. So I think the onus is not just on the GPs, but on the LPs as well, to be able to absorb and adapt these standardized reporting templates within their own technological platforms and MI reporting platforms. Yes, the regulatory reporting, you have to address it. That's in addition to the industry best practices. That's something all the GPs will have to take care of, whether it's, you know, additional reporting or ad hoc reporting. I think that's my view from an LP's perspective, but like you mentioned, from a GP's perspective as well. sometimes the GPs might not necessarily have the budgets and they'll have technological constraints to be able to adopt some of these in-depth reporting guidances and templates. Majority of our clients are smaller fund managers, first-time fund managers, where they don't necessarily have, you know, the bandwidth and the capabilities compared to a larger fund manager to be able to adopt these best-in-class practices. Also, I think it depends on the LP base as well. Like, the larger LPs are likely to have more institutional money, mm-hmm. where some of these requirements have originated. So I think that's been, you know, a challenge for some of our smaller GPs, first-time fund managers, where they do want to adopt these best practices, but they necessarily don't have the bandwidth or the budgets. And now that if they're doing it in-house with ILPA's guidance saying that those costs should not be recharged back to the fund, it makes it even more difficult to increase these kind of spends when they're doing it in-house. Yeah. So I think these are the kind of challenges which I would...
Yeah.
Hugh, you wanted to come in there.
Also, the reporting requirements are sort of shifting. So, for example, ESG, for example, everyone's talking about ESG, but ESG to one LP will be different from another because of their background, of their, you know, if it's an LP who's a tobacco company, you know, they'll have different ESG reporting requirements, or if it's an Islamic investment group or whatever, they'll have different reports. So that. There, I think there's a bit of ambiguity around what a GP should be reporting on, because it's quite specific to that type of investor.
Yeah, just wanted to ask quickly, Jeffrey, as an LP, what is your view on standardization? Is it desirable? Does it make your life easier? Or do you have scope to give different managers a degree of leeway in what they send to you, and you have the machinery to adjust it as you require?
No, absolutely. I mean, I think standardization is helpful to make things more efficient. And that's where industry bodies play a core role, is trying to reconcile everyone's differently worded requests and trying to come up with a standard that people can accept. And I know GPs spend a disproportionate amount of time responding to ad hoc requests from larger LPs, because they have to, and to the extent that we can deal with that in a more efficient way. And, you know, the path to getting good portfolio company data has been set out long ago. It's a long journey, and there's been some progress, but I think as the industry matures, it's going to be a fundamental piece of it.
Okay, great. Thanks, Jeffrey. And Neil, what's your point of view as a GP? On standardization particularly?
Partner-led mid-market house. well, I think it's about priorities, actually. So going to what Jeffrey just said, one of the investments we made over the last couple of years is to put in a software called iLevel, mm-hmm. Which is a really good way of making sure that you get consistent and accurate portfolio reporting, because that is... after all, what we're all doing this for, the returns from that portfolio and making sure you know exactly what's going on in it. I'd say the second bit we've put money into is CRM. So we've signed up with DealCloud, and they have a very good CRM product. Used to be with a different one, so we can compare. And that's where we're spending the money, because CRM equals origination, origination equals deal flow equals portfolio. Then from the, you know, reporting side of things, there are more and more templates. We follow the Invest Europe one, and you don't necessarily have to do that in-house, which is why folks like IQEQ have a lot of mileage to come as more and more of this stuff gets outsourced. If you're sub-economic, the software is only getting bigger, more complicated, more expensive, and if somebody else can do it for you, great.
Okay, great, Neil. Thank you. I'm conscious that we are pushing after 4 o'clock, and I just wanted to squeeze in one last question. Jennifer, if I could direct this to you, and it goes back to that point that you mentioned about ESG, certainly something that is front of mind for managers and LPs in a way that it's never been before. On that point that you raised about how to report on it, how to measure it, is there any work you're doing to... set out any kinds of guidelines or gauge the expectations of LPs around this issue?
It's a great question. We are not working on guidelines. We are working on developing a set of resources for our members. And I find that it's, you know, it's often categorized as sort of a monolithic issue, but as Hugh and others have already pointed out, the definition of ESG success really is in the eye of the beholder or of the LP. And we find that for each member we speak to about where they are on an ESG journey, they're all in a different place. And they all define it differently. So I think the industry is still trying to have that conversation around, can we arrive at more common or harmonized understanding of what ESG success actually means and how we measure impact? And I would say a couple of additional things on that. One is, I think getting more resources out into the public domain that LPs and GPs alike can consult and take from as appropriate to their organizations is an important first step. For example, getting more examples of organizational ESG policies out into the world, getting examples of how different GPs and LPs are reporting, cataloging, and measuring ESG impact. And the PRI is, of course, an excellent, excellent resource in this regard. But I also think it is a journey, and we're going to continue to see progress, and importantly, demonstrating progress in this regard, demonstrating embrace of transparency more generally, can only help when we are thinking about how do we enhance and improve upon the image of private equity in all markets where we operate today.
Jennifer, thank you very much. And I think we will wrap it up there. Big thank you to my panelists, Jennifer Choi from ILPA, Hugh Oliver Stacey from IQEQ, Gaurav from IQEQ, Jeffrey Geiger from USS, Gus Black from Deckard, and Neil McDougall from Silverfleet. Apologies for the late start. Thank you very much for bearing with us. Good afternoon.